Just would like to offer a recap or something of this to perhaps place again some of these references, which may be slightly unusual, but I did refer to different fields, and the reason why, because that's actually how it is, but what the average person will tend to experience is themselves and something that they are witnessing, watching, touching, tasting, hearing, thinking. So they experience a duality. One aspect called myself, and there's everything else. You know? And that setup, which is normal, of course, is a problem. In its very structure is a problem. Because the relationship of the self, this self experience, and what it takes as other than itself, must always set up some kind of wanting. You know, I want to have that, or I want to get away from it. I own it, or I possess it, or how am I? There's a dissonance occurs in that. And particularly unwholesome tendencies start to arise in the aspect we call myself, which is to seek something, have something, gain something, stop something. And so it sets up this dissonant current in experience. And the self feels essentially rather besieged at times, or alone at times, or struggling at times to come to terms with what it's experiencing. This very setup is an illusion, since the self cannot be, although it's definitely a felt experience, cannot be said to exist independently of what it's experiencing. So it doesn't exist independently of what it's experiencing. So it's not really an independent self. Therefore, why bother to use the term? It's a particular factor arising in a much, in a total field. So fields are, you know, a bodily field, you know, mental field. These are examples of it. And then these are just factors arising, such as sensations, energies, feeling, just welling up around there, and also energies such as a lot of volitional energies, wanting, organizing, making, checking, balancing, fixing, you know, lots of volitional stuff happening in that, in the mental field. And these volitional qualities are called sankhara, and they are the real potentizers. So you have all this stuff floating around, you could say, and then what really gives it the charge is this volitional quality, which is selecting, fascinating, repelling, trying to make something happen. It's sending a particular creative force into that mix. But that's part of what's there, is this sankhara quality, which is a certain volitional wishing, wanting, resisting, not necessarily unwholesomely, but, you know, it could be wishing for the good. But this sends a particular volitional charge into that mix, and things start to take shape. So when the volition to have something arises, then suddenly what clusters are all desirable objects start forming around that. Yeah. When this volition has got a negative charge in it, then all these nuisances start clustering around it. All the things I don't like start happening. You know, it potentizes the disagreeable, or it potentizes the desirable, or it potentizes the worryable. If I've got a worry sankhara, put that in the mix, And all the things I can worry about start clustering. You know, it's sort of like a seed crystal. So you put a crystal, you've got a super saturated solution, you drop a crystal in, and it, the whole thing forms in that shape, in these potencies. And it's very convincing, very immediate. So he's, yeah, look, I really don't have anything to worry about, you know. And in that sankhara, that volitional quality, generates, one of its things, it generates a sense of a self. It forms kind of in the shadow of that. There's the wishing, and then the wishing generates, as it occurs, kind of generates somebody who wants to have. So it's a kind of shadow effect, ripple effect. It's not that I want something. Wanting creates a desirable and that which desires. These are all in the field of the mind. And it's all in it. There's nothing outside it. There's nobody trying to make it work. That's in the mix. So when we begin to at least theoretically understand that, we're particularly, you know, with our wilderness training, particularly on the lookout for these volitional tendencies, these sankhara tendencies. Just, you know, because they're going to start making realities occur. They're going to start creating a world for us. You know, you drop one of those in and all this stuff crystallizes around it. The worryable, the things I feel gloomy about, despondent about, there they all are. I'm in a world of that. So we want to be really attuned to that, because this definitely potentizes a world that then, you know, the one who is generated feels overwhelmed by it. And then this self that gets generated, feeling overwhelmed, carries also the volitional tendency to try to be managing it all, and then failing. So the self is always has a certain wounded quality to it. Now in our experience, then we have these mental fields, which are to do with perceptions, that is, meanings, impressions, the friendly, the hostile, things that have meaning for us. Those perceptual stuff occurs, and direct qualities of the agreeable tones, senses of uplift, enjoyable qualities. That's there in the mind, in the mental field. Disagreeable ones, perceptions, feelings, and these volitional tendencies or activations, or right, they're called sankhara, and they're the ones you've to be very attuned to, because they're the ones that will generate seemingly solid realities. That then, as they solidify, they form a self who is in a rather difficult relationship with them. Now, with the stilling of those sankharas, the cooling of it, the sense of the self also becomes less intense. It cools, it becomes more amorphous, more lighter. Just becomes something like a concern or sensitivity. responsibility rather than obligation. And so there is this, you know, all this is in the field of the mind. As the human mind has certain innate qualities, such as as it rises up, it has a certain aspiration, a certain motivation quality, a seeking for harmony. It has an ethical quality, that which seeks balance and harmony and to feel, you know, integrate into the world. So it does have this a certain sense of an organizational attunement, like it seeks for the welfare. But then when these tendencies, these sankharas take over, it can become trying to control things, trying to stop things, trying to have things. It loses. It becomes too solid and inflexible until it pops out rather like a hernia. You know, it kind of then it feels strangled because it just, you know, it pops out of the, tries to pop out of the universe and get away from it all, and it's very uncomfortable. And then the loneliness and the my world doesn't fit anymore, I can't do anything, I'm hopeless, I'm useless. It's extremely unpleasant experience. So in our practice then we are really, you know, really opening to embrace all of that in the field. Yeah. And why? Because you cannot, you know, fix or solve the problem with the same mindset that generated it. You know, the state of consciousness that generates a separate self cannot resolve the problem of the separate self. Because the separate self is the problem. Or the key to the key of the problem. So we begin to say, what will help to allay the sense of the separate self? Or to just to be included? All of the tangle, the grogginess, the struggling, just to include it all. We don't enjoy it all, we don't like it all, but we are getting our awareness to sense all of that as it happens. And here we're using the body as something that will give the mind a certain grounding, a certain steadying effect, so that we can, you might say, we hold our minds in our bodies. We feel, you know, the energies of our emotions, you know, and we have this sense of the bodily holding presence with that, like a witness. Feel that sense of the steady breathing, grounded body with space around it, just being there as the mind is kind of struggling, and you can also sense that presence. And just holding the two together. Now there are the two other fields I mentioned. One is the field of Dhamma, and this is also sankhara. These are transpersonal sankharas. These are sankharas that lead to liberation. The flavour of all the Dhamma field is a liberating tendency, so that we potentize around goodwill. Say, let's just send a current of goodwill through all this. Sense of may the ceasing to resist, the non-aversion, the blessing, the loving, the embracing, the healing, the sense of putting balm onto the wound, you know, not criticizing it all the time, more compassionate. So we send, you can send this, potentize around this, you know, however it manifests. It doesn't mean we like things, it means that we do not generate the quality of ill will and rancor, you know. There's a sense of acceptance, patient, loving acceptance of that. So this is, you know, a very one example of a particular aspect of the Dhamma field. And of course, the Buddha presented a whole many of them. But this one is particularly pertinent. Naturally, it is the whole atmosphere within which we practice. We are practicing for our welfare, with the understanding, if I get a little bit more sane and grounded, there's a good chance I could help somebody else. But if I don't get this sorted out, I'm a disaster. So, you know, let's be pragmatic. You know, if you drown, you can't drag anybody else out of the muck. So get this one clear, and naturally the way that the citta is, it tends to radiate and permeate and touch whatever it comes into contact with. So the qualities of the healthy citta will make their presence felt, you know, this we can feel. So this is the potency of the Dhammas, Dhamma practices. And just to reiterate that, it's not like here am I shoveling metta in all directions, but just even bringing up and revering. So this is what puja is about. We just select a quality of Buddha, like Mahakaruna, Metta Karuna. We just sort of visualize or sense that, the blessing gesture, the open spaciousness, the unflagging compassion of a Buddha, you know, who kept it going till his last breath to serve when he had no need to. And that unflagging, cool, steady offering of sympathy and compassion. So we meditate like that. You bear that in mind. You venerate that quality. So this is where you take selected dhammas and honor them, so they become quite, they're not just thoughts, they become real palpable experiences, you know, that have deep meaning for us. And then you sit in that and you breathe in that, and some of the qualities of that begin to be really felt in the heart. You know, when we are touched, we feel those. So you using puja and using recollection to take what's conceptual, loving kindness, good idea. Okay, let's really make that something that's a bit stronger than just an idea. Feel it in the heart. How's that feel when that came to you, when goodwill was shown to you, when forgiveness was shown to you, when people said, oh, it doesn't matter, that's okay, was shown to you, or let me help you, was shown to you. And whenever you are able to manifest that, you take those instances and linger on them, they become great. This is the power of the mind, the power of attention. What you linger on becomes great, and you dwell upon it. And then carrying that, you begin to get, then you've potentized that quality, and you're putting that into the mind field. Now, this also affects the body, because the energies of the mind are embodied. That is, the stress of the mind creates bodily tension. You know, the confusion of the mind creates bodily confusion, and so forth. So, the more that you deeply take these qualities in and breathe them, and you just, as you're feeling the quality of goodwill, just notice how your breathing is, how your body is, and turn that attitude towards your body, any aspect of your body, the feeling tone, the muscles, you know, like you really want to accept and be with that, and listen to it and open to it. Your body begins to relax, and some of its stress ceases, and the quality that gives tremendous gravity and strength to the what this experience, say for example, experience of goodwill, becomes much more than just an idea. Becomes something that's got a real power to it. So that, you know, you kind of lock it into your body, if you like. So when ill will comes your way, you can hold your ground and not take it on. The problem of the mind is whatever it touches, it tends to be affected by it. It tends to be very permeable. So when we witness or experience the ill will, the negativities, the poisons, it easily infiltrates our own awareness. So we need this body to be strong, just to have our own ground and not taking that on. And so this is the value of samadhi. When you generate the Dharma potency, you linger upon it and you get it planted or embedded in your bodily consciousness, so it acts as a tremendous power to resist negative influences. The other field I mentioned was the karmic field, I called it. Perhaps it's a short way of putting it, but it's the field of our inheritance. And I made a proviso there. This doesn't mean it's something that you personally generated. In fact, there's nothing that you personally generated. Certainly there are reactions that arise called karma. There is this responsive quality that action occurs. And we can stop those actions. We can change those actions. We can divert those actions. This is called karma. It means you're making selective choices out of which possibilities you follow. Your mind crystallizes around, follows, determines. That's karma. But we are karma potent. It means we've got a strong tendency while we're alive in this citta, has a very strong potential to generate inclinations and actions. That's what it is to be alive, isn't it? It's a tremendous capacity to think this, think that, go here, go there. We're volitionally very fertile. And so the sense is, be a bit more choosy about what you want to be really follow. And that's karma. That's the teaching on karma. Every action, everything you determinedly do will definitely have its effects. The effects will be residues. And so this is our inheritance, residues of what we have followed. But often what has to be borne in mind that we also, because the mind is so affected by the what it comes into with birth, which is the sensory paradigm, with all its feelings and things that excite, attract, frighten, disgust, all that stuff going on. So that generates a tremendous karmic interest to, get the good stuff and get away from the bad stuff. So we start getting pretty frisky in there. So this is one inheritance. Another inheritance is more complex, which is the human inheritance. So the familial inheritance, our family, what we were approved of, disapproved of, loved, not loved, rejected, welcomed, blamed, adored, and all that stuff. So that's definitely had its shaping upon what we felt we could do, should do, and so on. And particularly generates a sense of how inclusive we are to our minds. How ashamed we are of ourselves is one of the big things that human conditioning comes up with. You know, with the at any level of it, then there's always a sense of you shouldn't be like that. That's not proper, that's naughty, that's disgusting, that's inadequate. So you get this, this is one of the inheritances we carry, the feeling of, you know, I'm not all allowed. So that creates a kind of certain karmic inclination, doesn't it? It creates a certain pressure to that which is shameful shouldn't be here. That which, where did the shaming come from? You know, who said it shouldn't be here? But we took that on. So in our early years, we are very porous, very permeable, and we take on a certain praise, blame, shaming effects. So then certain aspects of our experience shouldn't be like that. And so you've got this, this sets up a certain karmic tilt, doesn't it? Right? Because it is that way. Whether it should be or not, it is. And so shoulding it doesn't, shouldn't it, saying it shouldn't doesn't do much apart from just add another layer of stuff on top of it, right? And then you have the socio-cultural domain with all the messages that, again, we are flooded with and we get infiltrated with and we follow. So, or we are, sets us up. Sets up our trajectory in life, sets up our values, sets up our meaning, sets up our possibilities of what we could do, should do, good person, worthwhile, useful, and so forth. So it sets up a huge karmic pressure to what we will select. We will tend to select what the socio-cultural human domain says is the good, the right, the purposeful. Yeah? And it will not include all of us, that's for sure. And when I say not all of us, I mean, it won't include all of me, let alone all everybody in the room. Won't it, not all of me will be included in that. Only a certain fragment, probably. So it's compression into rather narrow, driven being gets formed out of that. With stuff that she or he should not have, but does have. That he or she shouldn't be, but somehow feels they are. So, what the personhood does with that is they either run a bit faster to get away from that, or they dumb it, they numb it out. You know, that which shouldn't be doesn't exist. That which, you know, so it's sort of, we keep moving fast enough to not experience it, or we close it down. And the effect of that has a bodily effect. The body gets used to act as the lock. You know? So by blocking the bodily energy, it means certain aspects of our humanity can be closed. Such as our rage or our grief or something like that, powerful, so we can lock it. So this isn't something we necessarily can think doing, but it's a psychic reflex that definitely occurs. And I think you're probably, you know, familiar with this understanding of blocked, shut down experiences and how the body energy is co-opted into doing that. So, you know, sounds a bit depressing, doesn't it, really? And yet, there is the Dhamma. And there's something in us something there, the aspiration, of, which is so natural to the jitta, to the heart, it's there. It's still there. It's that, you know, that flower pushing up through the concrete, as it were, still there. And because we're human. Yeah. And it starts, how do you get out? How do you do? Yeah. And so here we are. So it's in these fields and their interplay. But held like in that way, then it you see that what that understanding does of dhammas, of factors and characteristic means, there's nobody really finally locked into any of this in any position. That's where it can seem, the lock seems to be me. And then we get into it, then it freezes our aspiration. Because I'm only this, and what can I do? There you get the kind of the real hammer lock. But when we begin to see, you know, the aspiration, the kindness, the Dhamma factors can arise at any moment. If we come out of our lock, out of that self-view, and self-view which is probably driven, goal-oriented, trying to make things happen, trying to be on top, trying to get away from what it feels is shameful or useless or waste of time or shouldn't be there, we just stop running and open to that with this quality, using the body to help us stay present and open and grounded, and using loving acceptance to keep widening. What can we, you know, patiently bear with, breathe through? And this is the way of dispelling the acquisitions. So they lose their potency. Stilling of sankharas. So, you know, the relinquishment of acquisitions, that they dissolve. Liberation. So this is field. So just to place that there, any of that, if that helps to keep the topic in mind of what we're referring to, what I'm referring to. It comes down to, again, just basic practice, you know. So this feeling, because the program self is a very exclusive mechanism. It's been generated out of exclusivity, to discount, to not notice, to you know, only form around goal orientation and what it should be, and to not open into the wholeness of being. So basic practice is to open, use our aspiration vehicle and our energy to open and take an interest in the entire bodily experience as it's happening, and generating goodwill and acceptance, breathing through, and the body begins to respond. Starts to come out of its numbness or its trappedness and feel loved and accepted and welcomed back. And this is where some of these locks, you know, can begin to release, and we get emotional shifts, which we weren't. So if you release the body, the emotions shift, the psychology shift when the body shifts. And that's a way to do it. I won't say it's the only way, but it's certainly a way that is available, and it is very direct, because you're dealing with something, you're not that there isn't a self involved with that. And self is the problem. Self is a result of the problem. There isn't a self involved with that. Certainly there's intentionality, there's care, there's sensitivity, there's integrity, there's receptivity. These are beautiful mental factors. That's there. There's certainly volition, interest, that's there. But these factors can operate, and we begin to operate taking them beyond the boundaries of my personal narrowness, my self, my goal orientation, my what I've limited myself to be. So we cultivate that in our body, and of course in terms of retreat we're cultivating that in the general. We're taking that, putting our attention into, you know, how we work, how we chant, you know, really everything handled with this quality of mindfulness and care and receptivity. So let's have some time to practice in silence this evening. It can be very helpful to internally talk, if you like, or say, what's happening? What's happening? You know, where's my body? Is it safe? What's the mood? So I have this curiosity with, you know, the being able to just send certain inquiries, and that which we notice, feeling kind of murky or tangled, what's helpful here, where's that? So we even though we're silent in terms of speech, you keep the mind awake and using this mental interest to track experience and to contemplate it.